Thank you very much, Rabbi Shulman. The topic or the title of my talk is American Jewish History 101, Things You Never Learned in School. Before I begin, let me say that I spoke here two years ago, in May of 2004. Sometimes when I finish giving a class, somebody will say to me, well, how did the lecture go? So I say, well, you have to ask the victims, the students, not me. I can think it goes great, but it can be a disaster. So I consider the fact that I was invited back to speak a second time to indicate that I obviously did not do too badly last time. Now, things you never learned in school. Let me throw out some names. Aaron Lopez, Samuel Nunez, David Mikado, Rebecca Mikado Phillips, Louis Moses Gomez, David Gomez, Benjamin Gomez, Isaac Leeser, Abraham I. Abrahams, Raskis family, Rebecca Gratz, Jacob Mordechai, Asher Levy, Jacob Bar Simpson, Rabbi Abraham Rice, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Drachman, Harry Fischel, Gershon Kershid. I would venture to say, without doing a poll, that most of those names are essentially meaningless to most people in this room. Let me throw out some places. Recife, Brazil, Curacao, Suriname, Nevis, Savannah, Georgia, Philadelphia, Richmond, New Orleans, Warrentown, North Carolina, Jamaica, Newport, St. Louis. These are all places that play a role in American Jewish history. And by the way, American Jewish history is not limited to North America. There was a good deal of Jewish history, a good deal of things of interest that went on in the Southern Hemisphere also. Somebody said to me when he heard that I was speaking about this topic, he said, the only thing I ever learned in yeshiva about American Jewish history was that Chaim Solomon financed the American Revolution. I said to him, I hate to tell you this, but it ain't necessarily so. Indeed, it's not so. I'm not going to talk about it, but documentation shows that he really did not finance the American Revolution. He simply did not. He didn't have the money. He lent money to Madison, and he helped sell certain bonds that financed the revolution, but he certainly did not finance it. But I shattered one thing. I don't want to shatter too much more for right now. Now, first of all, how did I become a quote-unquote historian? What do I do for a living? I am a college professor. I teach mathematics. That's what I was trained to do, and that's what I am supposed to do. Also seem to have trouble with technology. Now, I wrote a Jewish Press article in 2004 about secular studies in the yeshiva, and about the terrible attitude that I had personally witnessed on the part of certain boys when it comes to secular subjects. I used to tutor math. And boys would come, and they would come in, and the kid would say, I didn't really want to be here, but my mother made me come. My father made me come. What do I need it for? What do I need it for? So I'd take out the Vilna Gaon Sefer Ayil Mishulash, and I said to him, you ever hear of the Vilna Gaon? Oh yeah, I heard of him. I say, see, parallel lines, side angle side. Oh, geometry, trigonometry, it's all here. Kid looks at me, doesn't know what to make of it. Comes back the next week, invariably, they come back the next week and with one of two responses. He wrote it in the bathroom. I said to the kid, do you think that the Vilna Gaon sat in a tile chamber like you sit in? Have you ever been in an outhouse? Are you serious? Or he wrote it before he was bar mitzvah. Now, it's the only sefer that the Vilna Gaon published during his lifetime. And I spoke to a friend of mine who knows a good deal about the Vilna Gaon and his approach to secular subjects, and he did not write it before he was bar mitzvah. I became concerned. Kids who don't know fractions, kids who can't read, kids who can't speak. It's a disaster, a disaster. Many of these boys don't have the basic skills to take ninth grade mathematics. They simply don't, and you can't expect them then to perform. So I wrote an article about this. I suggested some things that the yeshiva curriculum might deal with. First of all, my point is the following. You have this time set aside for secular subjects. Do something meaningful with it. Don't make it a joke. Don't make it nonsense. And make it relevant. And furthermore, my thesis is that the secular subjects should be within the framework of Limudei Kodesh. That it should fit together in some way. As a result, I proposed, although no principal has ever listened to me, why don't you teach the Vilna Gaon Sefer Ayil Meshulash in the 12th grade? You give Math A, Math B. 12th grade will be the Vilna Gaon Sefer Ayil Meshulash. It's a Sefer in geometry and trigonometry. We have an excellent now Hebrew translation to go with it. The kids might even learn some Hebrew, Chas v'Chalila, that would be a disaster. And wouldn't it make sense then? The kid couldn't say to me then, what do I need this for? You need it because you're going to study it in the 12th grade. You're going to study the Vilna Gaon Sefer. Nobody will listen to me. Nobody will listen to me. The article in the Jewish press, Secular Subjects in Yeshiva, got a tremendous response. Both letters to the editor and emails to me. Parents are really concerned about what their children are, well, quote unquote, not learning. Not learning. One woman wrote a letter to the Jewish press saying, Dr. Levine writes very nicely, but where's his curriculum? Where's the curriculum to go with what he's talking about? So, this encouraged me to actually look at the curriculum, to look at some of the things that might be there. By the way, some of the things that might be there, public speaking. Something that I could, that's known as précis writing, in which you teach a young person how to take an article and boil it down into one paragraph. How about comparative shopping? How about being able to read a map? You know how many people can't read a map? It's unbelievable. How about basic plumbing and carpentry? Survival skills. How about nutrition? How about basic accounting? How about childhood medicine? How about sewing? And how about cooking, even for the boys? Why? Nebuch, they occurred in my block a couple of years ago. A young woman with two daughters passed away. Husband was left with the two daughters. He didn't know how to do anything. It's a disaster. It's a disaster. Now, many people contacted me, but interestingly enough, no one from any yeshiva ever contacted me. Never heard a word from anybody from yeshiva. So I sat down and said to myself, what would I do with the curriculum? What would I do? The one thing, of course, is my Ayil Meshulash in the senior year. But something else that jumps out at you is, and by the way, let's understand something. Most yeshiva high schools, girls and boys, are giving a Regents diploma. Now, a Regents diploma is designed for people who are going to go to college. I don't understand. Does it make sense to tell the students not to go to college and give them a college education in high school? Am I missing something? If you really are true to your principles and you don't want them to go to college, if that's what you, I'm not saying that's what it should be. I'm not against college per se. I have an approach to that too, but not now. But shouldn't the curriculum reflect what you have in mind? One of the things that jumps out at one is the fact that a year of American history is required in New York and virtually every place else in the country. Now, shouldn't that year of American history in some way or other reflect the fact that you're teaching in a yeshiva? Shouldn't it deal, at least in part, with topics that are related to the yeshiva education? I felt yes, and I did what I often do. I began to search on the internet, and I came up with the following. On November 15, 1862, President Abraham Lincoln announced the following. The importance for man and beast of the prescribed... Sorry, folks. He issued an order saying the importance for man and beast of the prescribed weekly rest, the sacred rights of Christian soldiers and sailors, a becoming deference to the best sentiments of a Christian people, and a due regard for the divine will demand that Sunday labor in the Army and Navy be reduced to the measure of strict necessity. Now, this order, because it was aimed merely at Christians, exclusively at Christians, provoked some interesting comment in the Jewish community. And a gentleman by the name of B. Berend of Narrowsburg, New York, wrote a letter to the President of the United States, to Abraham Lincoln. And that letter, I felt, is something that our youngsters should be exposed to. Here's the letter. To His Excellency Abraham Lincoln, the President of the United States, by your order of the 16th day of November 1862, you recommend that the officers and men of the army shall observe the Sabbath and do no work on Sunday, because we are a Christian people. But according to the Declaration of Independence, and according to the Constitution of the United States, the people of the United States is not a Christian people, but a free, sovereign people with equal rights. And each and every citizen of the United States has the right and liberty to live according to his own consciousness in religious matters. And no one religious denomination, be it a majority or a minority, of the people can have a privilege before the other under this, our beloved Constitution. Now, by the order of your excellency, you give the privilege to those officers and men in the army who by their religious creed do observe the Sunday as a holy day and a day of rest. But you make no provision for those officers and men in the army who do not want to observe the Sunday as a holy day. As, for instance, those Christians called the Seventh-day Baptists and the Jews who observe the Saturday as a holy day and a day of rest, that they may enjoy the same privilege as those who observe the Sunday as a holy day, as well as for the heathen or the so-called infidels who do not want to celebrate either the Sunday or the Saturday as a Sabbath, but choose perhaps some other day as a day of rest. Now I stand before you as your namesake Abraham stood before God Almighty in days of yore, and ask, shall not the judge of all earth do justice? So I ask your excellency, the first man and president of all the United States, shall you not do justice? Shall you not give the same privilege to a minority of the army that you give to the majority of it? I beseech you to make provision and to proclaim in another order that also all those in the army who celebrate another day as the Sunday may be allowed to celebrate that day which they think is the right according to their own conscience. And this will be exactly lawful as the Constitution of the United States ordains it, and at the same time will be exactly according to the teaching of the Bible as recorded in Leviticus 19:18, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I gave my consent to my son, who was yet a minor, that he should enlist in the United States Army. I thought it was his duty, and I gave him my advice to fulfill his duty as a good citizen, and he has done so. At the same time, I taught him also to observe the Sabbath on Saturday, when it would not hinder him from fulfilling his duty in the army. Now I do not want that he shall be dragged either to the stake or the church to observe the Sunday as a Sabbath. Your Excellency will observe in this my writing that I am not very well versed in the English language, and if there should be found a word which is not right, pardon it, and never such a word shall be construed so as if I would offend your excellency or the people. For I love my country, the Constitution, and the Union, and I try to be always a loyal citizen. I remain, respectfully, your most obedient servant and fellow citizen, B. Barron, Narrowsburg, Sullivan County, December 4, 1862. That letter to me is terribly interesting. Terribly interesting. And why young people don't know about that letter? Well, I know why. Because nobody did the research. By the way, it's a click, ladies and gentlemen. It's a click. There's an entire Civil War site that deals with Jews, both in the North and the South. By the way, I do not know what Lincoln responded or if he ever did respond. I have not been able to determine that. It's believed that the soldier who the father was writing about was Private Herman Barron of the 41st New York Infantry, a regiment formed in Sullivan County, which included a very large number of Jewish recruits. This led to an interest in American Jewish history, which has become, I guess, a passion is the only way to describe it. It has led me to write a monthly column in the Jewish press called Glimpses into American Jewish History. And the more I find out, the more fascinated I am. Now, I have a prejudice in my interest in American Jewish history. I am not interested in just some American Jewish history. I'm interested in people who remained observant despite unbelievable obstacles. So my focus is on observance. My column deals exclusively with people who are observant. A guy sent me an email, I don't know how he found out about my column, that it's the something anniversary of Lewis Marshall, who was a great Jewish blah, 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 blah. I recall vaguely Lewis Marshall. I searched on the internet. I saw that he was a member of the Reformed Temple and blah, blah, blah. I wrote him back and I said, my focus is on observance. I'd like to know something about his religious observance. So he had somebody else send me an email message that he was brought up in an Orthodox home in Syracuse, New York. When the temple or the synagogue there became Reform, his parents didn't leave it. But he wrote me, he was a great Jewish leader. I wrote him back, he may have been a leader who was Jewish, but because he was not observant, he was not, in my opinion, a great Jewish leader. There is a difference, ladies and gentlemen, in my opinion. Now, when you go even to the Jewish museums, you go to the American Jewish Historical Society. A while ago, they had an exhibit, and there was a picture of Aaron Lopez. By the way, all those Spanish-sounding names, those are early Portuguese and Spanish Jews who fled the Inquisition and came here and really established Judaism here. You see Aaron Lopez. There was a write-up, I remember, that Rebecca Gratz. Zero mention that they were Shomer Shabbos. Aaron Lopez was a Shomer Shabbos fellow. We're not going to talk about him tonight. But his ships did not load or unload on Shabbos. They did not, absolutely did not. He exported kosher meat to the West Indies. We have letters from Christians that were sent to him. I know you can't meet with me because today is the festival of Passover. This, to me, is a crucial point. Now, I'm going to talk about three things. And I chose them because they're off the beaten path. I'm going to talk about a gentleman by the name of Israel Bear Kershid. I'm sure that, well, does that ring a bell with anyone? I hope not, because I chose it, so it shouldn't. Israel Bear Kershid, 1766 to 1852. And then, if there's time, and I think there will be time, I'm going to speak about an island called Nevis. Anybody hear of Nevis? Okay, so we got some. And also about the Raskas family of St. Louis. But let's first focus on Israel Bear Kershid, 1766 to 1852. My sources, first of all, how did I find out about him? I was reading a book about Richmond Jewry, and he's on two pages. he was supposedly this and this and blah, 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 blah. And it refers to references is something called the Asmonean, which is a paper that a Jewish paper that appeared in English in the 1850s. And the Occident, which is a publication of Isaac Leeser, which also appeared in the 1850s and 1860s. Now, how do you get these things? How do you get these things? Well, the Occident is easy to get because I have a friend, Yosef Goldman, and if you buy the Jewish Press tomorrow or get it, there'll be an article there, I believe, called Hooked on American Jewish History. And Yossi Goldman has an unbelievable collection of Judaica. Unbelievable. And he's willing to lend it to me, and he's willing to help me out. Getting the Asmonean 1852 newspaper, a little more difficult. A little more difficult. Now, Stevens has a library, which I use for my historical pursuits. And they get many things for me. They couldn't get me this. But believe it or not, the New York Public Library, somebody there, I sent him an email, and somebody answered back. And first she faxed me a copy of the thing. It was illegible because it's very old, taken off of microfiche. And then she actually mailed me the thing, the paper, and so I was able to get that. Now, let's understand something about early American Jewry. No ordained rabbis stayed here from 1654 until 1840. The first ordained Orthodox rabbi was Rabbi Abraham Rice, who came here in 1840. And he had a pulpit in Baltimore. When he got to Baltimore, he found sheer chaos in the American Jewish community there. And by the way, that's the way it was everywhere. There were no Rabbonim, no Talmidei Chachamim. There was nobody, nobody. There were Chazanim. These were the people who, they led the prayers, and some of them had a better than average Jewish education, and they were the quote-unquote officials. There were some educated Balabatim, there were Moalim. Many of them were businessmen, and this was a sideline. There were no Torah teachers. There was nothing here till 1840. It was sheer chaos. Now, there is one exception to this, but it's not in the Northern Hemisphere. It is Recife, Brazil. That is a community that was established in 1630 and ended in 1654. Now, Recife is interesting. The Portuguese captured Brazil originally, but then the Dutch captured a certain section of Brazil, and Recife, which is a city in Brazil on the resort sort of city, all of a sudden they began crawling out of the woodwork, Jews. People who admitted to being Jews. Why? Because the Dutch had a very, very liberal attitude towards religious observance. Many Muranos did their best to get to Amsterdam, because in Amsterdam you could live openly as a Jew. There were Jews who had come to the New World to escape the Inquisition. The Inquisition was nowhere near as strong here in the New World as it was in Spain and Portugal. And in 1630, when the Dutch conquered Recife, Jews began to appear. And then something unbelievable and unprecedented happened in 1642. In 1642, the Amsterdam Jewish community sent a contingent of qualified Torah teachers to Recife. Rabbi Isaac Abov was one of them. He became the religious leader of the community. A shul with a mikveh. They excavated. We know where the mikveh was. A yeshiva. A real yeshiva. Built on the Amsterdam style. Was formed there. And in fact, if anything, Recife became a suburb of Amsterdam when it came to Jewish subjects. It was a real community. There were at least two synagogues there. It flourished. And then Nebuch, what happened is that the Portuguese tried to recapture this section of Brazil, and they were successful. And in 1654, they captured Recife. And all the Jews left in mass because they did not want to live under the possibility of the Inquisition. They were allowed to leave in a decent way. And many of the ships sailed back to Amsterdam But one ship, as perhaps you know, ended up in New Amsterdam in New York, and that's where the first 23 Jews came from Recife, Brazil. Now, there was one Talmud Chacham in America before 1800. Israel Ber Kershid. Again, he was born in 1766. Now, he was born in Singhaven, Germany, near the Rhine, on the fourth day of Pesach in 5626. That's April 6, 1766. He was orphaned at a young age, and his mother relocated to Kershid near Königswinter. Now, German Jews in general did not have last names. He took Kershid as his last name. He showed a brilliance as a youngster, and he was sent to the yeshiva of Rav Nosson Adler. Rav Nosson Adler, 1741 to 1800 in Frankfurt. Yeshiva of Rav Nosson Adler is a big place in Yiddishkeit. The most famous student of the yeshiva was Rav Moshe Schreiber. That's the Chassam Sofer, 1762 to 1839. Kershid was a good student. Among his fellow students were two who particularly distinguished themselves and attained considerable eminence. Rav Abraham Bing, Abraham Bing, 1742 to 1841, and Rav Wolf Heidenheim, 1757 to 1832. Rav Bing became the chief rabbi of Würzburg. His students include Rav Yaakov Ettinger, Rav Nathan Marcus Adler, Chacham Isaac Barnes, and Rav Zelig Ber Bamberger. These are famous names in Jewish history, ladies and gentlemen. Rav Heidenheim is known for his many literary publications, including a Hebrew commentary on and a German translation of the Machzer. In fact, the Reudelheim Machzer, which was printed under his auspices in Reudelheim, is because of him. So these are two people who were not little fellows. Why do I mention them? Because according to the Asmonean and other articles, Rav Nosson Adler held these three students, Bing, and Heidenheim, and Kershid, in equal estimation. Rav Adler used to say that Rav Avraham was a charif, he was an acute logician. Rav Wolf, a medactic, because he was a grammarian. And Rav Yisrael, that's Kershid, a chacham, a wise man whose accomplishment in Torah learning were universal. Rabbi Yisrael's studies were interrupted in 1792 by the French Revolution. General Adam Kustin invaded Frankfurt. By the way, the Jews were severely limited and discriminated against in Frankfurt. To just show how angry they were at what was done to them, when the French army invaded Frankfurt, there was a question of where should they camp. So they said, "Habitat, don't ask me why." They asked some Jew. Now, there was a park in the middle of Frankfurt, a beautiful park, where no Jew was allowed to set foot. So this little Jew told them, camp in that park. They destroyed it. They destroyed it. I mean, you put an army in a beautiful park. Now, because of the French Revolution, Kershid had to interrupt his studies. And in some way or other, he was a resourceful fellow. He was able to obtain a contract to supply the Prussian army. Now, how a sheltered yeshiva boy was able to do this, I have no idea. The danger of dealing with Gentile military personnel, but yet he did it. The peace in 1795 ended his business, and so he decided to leave Germany. After all, in Germany, when you wanted to cross a bridge, there was a special Jew tax. Everything, there were special discriminatory laws. So he went to Hamburg with the idea of going to London. But for some reason or other, he heard about a ship that was going to Boston. And somebody had told him that in Boston, there's a vibrant Jewish community. There's a synagogue. So he went aboard this ship. He booked passage on a ship called the Simonov. It's a 70 to 80 ton vessel, a small ship. The passage took 70 days. The man did not speak. I'm sorry. The passage took 70 days. And the man did not speak English. And he was amongst all Gentiles. Now, it turned out that the captain of the ship was favorably disposed to him. So when it came time for Rosh Hashanah and for Yom Kippur, What he could do was he knew the chapter and verse in the Bible that talks about Rosh Hashanah and talks about Yom Kippur. So he showed the captain in the Bible, English Bible, which he himself couldn't read, but he showed him the chapters and explained to him as best he could what was going on. It took him 70 days. How he did it, it's unbelievable to me. He arrived in Boston at the end of 1796, and then he discovered that he had been hoodwinked. The entire Boston Jewish community consisted of one Jewish family. There was no synagogue, there was no community, there was no nothing. So it didn't take him long before he left for New York. Now, New York itself also had a small Jewish community. The number of Jews in America was really very, very small. According to the Rise of the Jewish Community in New York by Hyman B. Grinston, let me read to you a little bit of how many Jews were in New York. And New York was considered a mecca of Judaism at the time. In 1695, there were 100 Jews. In 1750, there were 300. In 1794, there were 350. In 1809, there were 450. In 1815, there were 350. In 1820, 450. 1825, 500. It's not until, say, 1842 where we get to 10,000. Jews were a fraction of the population, 100, 200, 300 Jews. Unbelievable. Khursheed's first impression of Jewish life in New York must have left him crestfallen. In material terms, the Jewish community consisted of a synagogue building on Mill Street, dating back to 1730, an adjoining chevra, meeting place and schoolhouse, the minister's house, and a cemetery on Chatham Square. Its upkeep was the cause of frequent outbreaks, disagreements among the trustees of Sheretz Israel, until 1825. It would be the only Jewish cemetery in New York City until 1825. They, the Jews of New York, knew little of Jewish traditions. Neglect, apathy, and petty bickering were pervasive. After all, who came to America? Usually, those who were running away from Europe. Again, there were no qualified yeshiva-educated personnel here. Khursheed was the only one. Khursheed quickly became known to a gentleman named of Gershom Mendesatius. It's S-E-I-X-A-S, but it's pronounced as Satius, 1745 to 1816. He was appointed Chazan of Sheretz Israel, which was the synagogue in New York, at the age of 23. He was not a rabbi. He served for almost 50 years in that position. He was known as the Patriotic Chazan because when the British conquered New York, he fled with virtually all of the Jewish community to Philadelphia, where they spent a number of years. Satius appreciated what Khursheed was. It didn't take him long to realize that he had a gem in his midst. He had somebody who we could ask shilas of. He had somebody who really knew how to learn. He had somebody with a real solid yeshiva education. Indeed, he quickly became close with him, and on January 18, 1804, he married Sarah Abigail, Sally Satius, the eldest daughter of Chazan Satius. Sarah was the favorite child of Reverend Satius, and Khursheed became his favorite son-in-law. Now, let me pause here and point out something to you. If you look at the portraits of these people, as I like to say, they did not wear their tzitzis out. What do I mean by that? They do not look Jewish. They are all clean-shaven. There are no yarmulkes in the pictures. That was the way of the time. That was the way of the time. But that doesn't mean that they weren't observant, that they weren't Shomer Shabbos. So do not be fooled by externalities. I have to repeat that. Do not be fooled by externalities. We live in a world in which externalities are becoming increasingly the guideline to everything. Sadly, sadly. Anyway, that's another talk. In New York, Khursheed went into business. As the Asmonean writes about him, he had his share both of prosperity and adversity, like all other men. But the one never rendered him arrogant. The other could not cast him down. There were in his character two remarkable traits that still kept him upright and enabled him to preserve the serenity of his mind: trust in God and good opinion of men. He was incapable of believing in the bad intentions of others. And though he more than once or twice suffered severity from his confidence being abused, he could not be persuaded that the cause was other than imprudence or folly on the part of those through whom he suffered. His trust in God was firm and not to be shaken, as it sprang from his profound conviction in the truth of his religion and consequently in the wisdom and goodness of providence. Now, Khursheed is a self-effacing personality. He was not the kind of guy to step forward. If he were asked, he would give his opinion. He was involved in some communal activities. He was interested in Jewish education. He appreciated that Jewish education was the key to the survival of the Jewish people. And he became involved in Yeshivat Minchat Arag, which was the Sherith Israel school that was established. And in 1808, he was appointed to a committee of six to draft a detailed proposal and regulations for the reorganization of the yeshiva into a real Jewish day school for boys and girls. The school remained active until 1822. Its aims, as articulated by Yisrael Baer, were: 1. To instruct students in the religion and morality. 2. To make sure that their actions are in harmony with these teachings. 3. To impress on their minds the excellence of our belief. In 1810, in recognition of his service to the Jewish community, Khursheed was elected Parnes, that is, president of Sherith Israel, and he served for one term. He fought many battles at Sherith Israel, and he lost most of them. One of the things he wanted to do was limit the number of mishaberachs to 3 per person. Does that sound familiar? Okay, they wouldn't buy it. He moved to Richmond, and he lived in Richmond from 1812 to 1824. He served as chazan of the Richmond Synagogue. There he came in contact with Isaac Leiser, a personality of fame, and with somebody by the name of Jacob Mordechai, also somebody who played an interesting role in Jewish history. He founded a girls' seminary, not for Jewish girls, in Warrenton, North Carolina, which from 1809 to 1819 he ran it there, and it was a classic school for girls, in which he showed, many people didn't believe it, that you could give women an academic education also. While residing in Virginia, Khursheed became acquainted with Thomas Jefferson and even visited him on more than one occasion at Monticello. He returned to New York. His family now consisted of 9 children, together with his wife. When he came back to New York, the Jewish community in New York was drastically different. There were a large number now of Ashkenazic Jews in New York. And they chafed under the fact that the only synagogue was according to the Sephardic Spanish-Portuguese ritual. And he attempted to start a minyan within Sherith Israel that would be according to Nusach Ashkenaz, but the Parnassim, the leaders of the Sherith Israel, would not go along with it. So he was forced with others to start the first Ashkenaz synagogue, B'nai Yeshurun, in New York. It's the second oldest congregation that followed Ashkenazic ritual. In about 1834, he played a key role in the establishment of something called Chevra Trumat HaKodesh, which raised money for the poor and indigent in Eretz Israel. And also in August of 1840, he chaired a gathering of New York's Jewish community to protest the Damascus affair. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Blood libel, that's right. When a Franciscan friar and his Muslim servant disappeared, the Jews of Damascus were accused of having killed them to use their blood for Jewish Passover rites. That should sound very familiar to us. This scourge has come down to us over the generations. A number of the Damascus Jews were arrested and tortured to make them, quote-unquote, confess to the crime. Some Jews died. Even Jewish children were taken prisoner. It was the first demonstration of American Jewry for something international dealing with Jews. His last days. According to the Asmonean obituary, IBK was more than beloved by his family. He was sick the last 2 years of his life. He was almost idolized. His family devoted themselves to caring for him during the last 2 years of his life when he was ill and suffering. During this period, he was confined to his home, and many came to visit him simply to be in the presence of a man who was a living example of a true Jewish patriarch. He passed away at the age of 86, surrounded by his family and friends. Someone present at his passing, witnessing his serenity of spirit, quote, involuntarily burst out in the words of Scripture, "May I die the death of the righteous, and may my end be like his." He's an exceptional man. An exceptional man. He's a model for us, ladies and gentlemen. He's a model for our youth. He's a model. But they don't know about him. How can he be a model if you don't know about him? He can't. By the way, he also accomplished something which is really an accomplishment in the times that he lived. Intermarriage was rampant amongst early American Jewry. He had 9 children. 8 of them married Jews. One never married. One never married. His most famous offspring, his most famous is his son Gershon Kershi. Gershon Kershi became friends with Judah Turo in New Orleans. And Turo really had no connection to Jewish things at one point in his life. And Kershi convinced him to leave hundreds of thousands of dollars for Jewish communities. And in fact, a big chunk of that money was spent in Eretz Yisrael to build certain things and establish certain things. Ad Kan Gershon, or Ad Kan Yisrael Kershi. I'm going to talk now about Nivus. Now, a guy came over to me in Shul about 2 months ago. He says to me, "I was in Nivus for something, and you know there was a Jewish community there? You should write about it." I said, "I had no idea." No idea. Who ever heard of Nivus? What is Nivus? Where is Nivus? The sister islands of the Federation of St. Kitts and Nevis lie about 225 miles southeast of Puerto Rico in the Leeward Islands in the Eastern Caribbean. Nivus is there. Nivus was, at a certain time, a crucial trade port. Charleston, which is the capital of Nivus. Jews were there by 1677. It was a small Jewish community, 17 families. By the way, that sounds like nothing to us. 17 families. You have to understand that other communities, first of all, again, if I tell you that there were 350 Jews in New York City, you get some idea of how small the Jewish community was. And in places like Jamaica and Curacao, also very small Jewish communities. Yet Nivus, which was a forgotten Jewish community, by the way, it was only rediscovered by Malcolm Stern, who happened to have been on a pleasure cruise. And when they stopped in Nivus, somebody mentioned that there's a Jewish cemetery here. And he was curious to see it. Stern was a well-known historian of American Jewish history. And he went to the cemetery and he saw that this is a place where there were Jews. And then he asked, "Well, is there a synagogue?" And they said, "Well, there's this ruin over here. That's the synagogue and this and that." It was forgotten. There was a synagogue. There was a Jewish school. And it ties in with somebody whom I'm sure you all know, Alexander Hamilton. What does Alexander Hamilton have to do with the Jewish community of Nivus? Well, Alexander Hamilton... birth was not, shall we say, the most favorable. His wife had been married to someone first, and then it's not clear whether she got divorced or if she was divorced on the condition that she would never remarry. In any case, she had a child, Alexander Hamilton, who was considered illegitimate by the church. And as a result, Hamilton was not allowed to attend the Christian school. There were no secular schools in those days. What did they do with him? They sent him to the Jewish school. He went to the Jewish school. Absolutely, he did. And he used to say that he remembers when he was a little boy standing on the table and saying the Ten Commandments in Hebrew. He had a basic knowledge of Hebrew, and he had also a very positive feeling toward Jews as a result.
And his mother was a Jew?
It's not clear. It's not clear at all whether his mother was Jewish. Some claim she was, some claim she wasn't, some claim the father was Jewish and not the mother. Not at all clear what was. Not at all clear. Okay, he himself never really spoke too much about his background. He didn't. His Hamilton's son later related that rarely, as he alluded to his personal history, he mentioned with a smile as having been taught to repeat the Decalogue in Hebrew at the school of a Jewess. When so small that he was placed standing by her side upon a table. Perhaps from this exposure at an impressionable age, Hamilton harbored a lifelong reverence for Jews. In later years, he privately jotted on a sheet of paper that the progress of the Jews from their earliest history to the present time has been and is entirely out of the ordinary course of human affairs. Is it not then a fair conclusion that the cause also is an extraordinary one? In other words, that it is the effect of some great providential plan? Later on, in the heat of a renowned legal case, Hamilton challenged the opposing counsel. Why distrust the evidence of the Jews, he said. Discredit them, and you destroy the Christian religion. Which is true, by the way. Which is true, by the way. The last thing I'm going to talk about, although, ladies and gentlemen, this is just the surface. There's so much to discuss. I'm going to talk about the Raskas family of New Orleans. These are later people. In 1882, Sholem Yitzchok, that's Isaac as he was known, and Shifra Rivka Raskas, immigrated from Kovno, Lithuania to St. Louis to join members of Mrs. Raskas's Sarensen family. Now, there's a website with some information about the Raskas family. Also, somebody put me in touch with a grandson, Stanley Raskas, of the Raskas family, who helped me out with a number of things in terms of supplying information. But you can see there a picture of Mr. and Mrs. Raskas' parents. They lived in Kovno. They were the old-time staunch Litvisha Yidden. Both men are wearing the big Litvisha yarmulkes, the old-fashioned Litvisha yarmulkes. The women are wearing the kerchiefs like they did. This was real, you know, deep stuff. They came to America, and the Raskases started a dairy. And they were undoubtedly, or probably, whatever, the first dairy to supply Chol of Yisrael in America. They did. Because he bought the milk from a Jewish farmer. He bought the milk from a Jewish farmer, and it was Chol of Yisrael. Now, it was a very primitive in the beginning sort of operation from a truck with that the milk was doled out, etc. But the dairy began to prosper. The Raskases had a number of children, and they did something which is astounding when you think about it. They sent two sons in 1900 to yeshiva to learn in Slabodka. Two sons in 1900. Now, no telephones, no email, a letter who knows when, right? The trip, don't fly, it takes a long, long time. By the way, two sons were Yudel, Julius, and Louis. That's Chaim Shabtsai Lev. Louis was 12 at the time when they sent him to Slabodka. Now they had relatives there, but they sent them to Europe. I believe that they are the first from North America to send children to learn in Lithuanian yeshivas. Now, after 1900, you have in Baltimore people sending in various other places, but this was a pioneering act. Louis learned in Slabodka, and then from Slabodka he went to Radin because he wanted to be near the Chafetz Chaim. And there he married Ruth Pupko, and he worked as a pharmacist. And his plan was to stay in Europe. After all, his wife was there, he had two children at the time. He was going to stay in Europe. What's wrong? He was doing well, basically. Then his father sent him a letter saying that he needed him to come home. because he wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael to look into the possibility of moving to Eretz Yisrael, and he needed someone to run the dairy in his absence. So he left his wife and children in Europe, in Lithuania, and he returned home to St. Louis to run the dairy. And then World War I broke out. And he was trapped here. He was trapped here. He had no contact with his wife for years. And his parents had left and gone to Eretz Yisrael. And he was left with the dairy. At the end of the war, of World War I, his wife and two children were still in Europe. And finally he made contact with them. Now, she wanted to stay in Rodden. And Ruth wanted him to come back to Europe. But he said he couldn't. He has this dairy business. What's he going to do? She didn't know what to do. She went and asked a relative, a Rav, what she should do. He said, you have two choices. Either you go to America, or you have him give you a get. You can't have it both ways. You have to make a decision. She decided to come to America. So Ruth Raskus arrived here in America in 1920. They became pillars of the Jewish community. They developed this little dairy business into a huge conglomerate. The Raskus family no longer owns it. I believe it was sold. By the way, Ann Raskus Candy is also from a relative, but that was started in Eretz Yisrael. It is a sister of this Louis Raskus, but that was started in Eretz Yisrael. They developed this successful dairy business. Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok Schneerson, the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, visited America from 1929 to 1930. When he came to America and when he visited St. Louis, Ruth Raskus cooked for him and prepared his meals. These are extraordinary people. I want to thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your patience, for your time. Thank you. Please, I will try to answer some questions, if there are. Sir?
Gershon,
yes.
Okay, he was the quintessential Ashkenazi. So did he adopt the Tzaddik Reich?
Well, Sheshes, he married Gershon Sheshes' daughter. Okay? Gershon Sheshes himself was half Ashkenazic. We have letters that Gershon Sheshes wrote to this daughter Sally, that's Kershid's wife, when they were in Richmond. And the letters have smatterings of Sephardic terms and Yiddish terms. Okay, but he was a member of Sheret Israel, and he adopted the practice. And by the way, it was not so hard for him to adopt the Spanish-Portuguese Nusach, because his Rebbe, Nosson Adler, davened according to the Sephardi tradition. I don't know if you're aware of that. In his yeshiva, the pronunciation was Sephardit. And he duchened every day. He was a controversial, Nosson Adler was an unusual personality, okay? So he did. Then he broke away and when they formed the Ashkenaz synagogue, when they Yeshurun, but eventually came back to share with Israel. But yet, see, let's understand something else. To marry, let's put it different. First of all, the Sephardic Jews in general look down on Germans. It's a sad thing to say, but many of them more readily married Gentiles, educated Gentiles, than Jews from Germany. And to marry into a Sephardic family was considered a big thing. It was an aliyah. Okay? So he married and you know, I don't know whether he ate rice on Pesach, that I can't answer you, but I know that he did certainly adopt those customs. Yeah. They were the predominant customs. There was nothing else, in fact, until 1820-something.
The grandees.
Yeah, La Nacion, they were known as. La Nacion, and if you look, you see, the sadness is that many of these families who had sacrificed so much for Judaism. I didn't speak about it, but let me just explain something. Let me take Aaron Lopez. Duarte Lopez, the most successful merchant during colonial times, lived in Newport. Born in 1732 in Portugal. Now, the Inquisition was established in Portugal in 1531. That's over 200 years living under the Inquisition. He escapes from Portugal. He's baptized. His wife Catherine is baptized. They were all baptized. There was no other way. That was it. Comes to Newport. What does he do? He has himself circumcised. He takes a Jewish name. His wife takes a Jewish name. He had himself circumcised. He takes a Jewish name, Aaron. His wife takes a Jewish name. His one daughter that he had at the time also took a Jewish name. He got married to Halacha. He became an observant Jew. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. After so many years of persecution, he is one of the founders of the Touro Synagogue, and he laid the first cornerstone. There are six cornerstones in the Touro Synagogue, four for the building and two for the schoolroom that's attached to it. These were extraordinary people, and yet, within two generations, many of them, assimilation was terrible. The Franks, who were not Muranos, who came here early Frank, they sent their oldest son to England so he would marry a Jew. Their daughter was here, she married a Christian. They were devastated. It was very difficult. Yes, anyone else? Sir?
I just wanted to say that some things that I happened to be in Davis once on the cemetery, basically some of the headstones from a couple hundred years that have Hebrew writings on them, as well as there's a foundation of the building over there that they claim is a synagogue.
It's not. Okay. There's a book. I got a hold of the book. There's a book. Somebody did a PhD thesis looking for the synagogue. And what they say was the synagogue is not the synagogue. It's believed to be in a different location. But there was a synagogue there. That's no question.
I also want to say that I went to school with Stanley Raskus.
Oh!
NYU, classmate. And I had Dr. Grinstein, Jewish history at Yeshiva University.
Yeah, So there's going to be an article, I think it'll be in February or March, about the Raskus family and my column, The Glimpse of American Jewish History. They're interesting people. Interesting. And inspiring people. That's the point. They're inspiring people. Our young people should know about them. Anyone else, please?
Can we go beyond your period?
Beyond my period? What does that mean?
Beyond the period that you covered into more recent American Jewish history.
More recent American Jewish history.
What are the people you spoke about?
Pardon?
I have a question about not what you spoke about.
You can ask. I may not know.
Well, could you explain the details of the episode of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the Rav HaKolel, how they got him, why he had troubles here?
I'm smiling because, are you aware that there was an anti-Semitic riot during his funeral? It was a huge anti-Semitic riot during his funeral. And, well, I'm going to write an article about it. Yaakov Yosef, first of all, one of the things that one can do is one can access the archives of the American Jewish Historical Society on the internet, and you can search them. It's amazing. Up until articles published up until 1978 or something. After that, I don't have access, and my school doesn't have access. But in any case, first of all, he was not the first choice for the position. There were others. There's an article about this in American Jewish Historical Society. There were others who also. He came, though, to America, and he attempted to institute order into kashrus. Kashrus was a problem. It's not just a problem today, ladies and gentlemen. It has always been a problem. And he decided that in order to do this, in order to have proper hashgacha, he needed to raise a certain amount of money. So he instituted a tax of a penny per chicken. A penny, which to us is nothing, but in those times was something. And people didn't like the idea of having to pay for it. And those who were connivers and who were devious when it came to kashrus didn't want his hashgacha anyway. And the whole thing deteriorated. Okay? And his life is a true tragedy. Then he was confined, he got sick and he was confined to bed for many years, and he was forgotten. He was forgotten. I have, by the way, and I hope to write about it also, Columbus Day. When did Columbus come to America? 1492? So 1892, he gave a speech about Christopher Columbus. The whole Jewish community, 400th anniversary of the coming of Columbus to America. This was a big deal, a big, big deal. And I have newspaper on that. I hope to write about that too sometime. In any case, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, who was an unusual, he was a Talmud Chacham, there's no question that he was somebody of stature. His life was a disaster, okay? And he was forgotten about, and then he died. And I don't know whether people felt guilty because they had ignored him or anything, but it was decided to make his levaya a big, big hullabaloo. A big, big hullabaloo. And people came out from everywhere who had never had anything to do with him, who never wanted anything to do with him, and they began to crawl out of the woodwork, as I say, you know. And the funeral had to go to... I can't think of what took them from Manhattan to Brooklyn, ferry. Okay, and they went by something called the Hoe Manufacturing Plant, H-O-E. And that was known to be a place of anti-Semitism, where the workers there had in the past thrown things at Jewish funeral processions. And it became an unbelievable situation there during Rabbi Yaakov Yosef's Levaya. In addition to that, the police in New York at the time were Irish. The Irish had virtually no sympathy for the Jews. So not only did the police not try to stop the pogrom, they participated in it. It was a huge, huge scandal. It's an unbelievable incident of anti-Semitism in American Jewish history. But Rabbi Yaakov Yosef attempted to instill order, and people in America didn't want order. Let's understand something. America was a free country, revolution. They didn't want a kehillah like you had in Europe. They didn't want a kehillah. I didn't speak about the Jacob Mordechai. There's a woman, Esther Whitlock, Evelyn Whitlock, who converted. That was his mother. Evelyn Whitlock, she converted and became Esther. And she married Moses Mordechai. She converted in England. She married a gentleman named Moses Mordechai, who was considerably older than she was. They came to America. They had three children. One of them is Jacob Mordechai, who was famous in Jewish history. In any case, why am I talking about her? Because it relates to Chaim Solomon, who we talked about a little bit. She was a Gioris. Her first husband died. They lived in Philadelphia. A gentleman named Jacob I. Cohen wanted to marry her. He was a Kohen. She's a Gioris. It's a no-no. It's a no-no. They wanted to get married. The Parnassim, the officials of Mikveh Yisrael, which was the synagogue in Philadelphia, said no. No way. But we have a Kesuvah. She did marry him. And Chaim Solomon signed on it. He signed on it. And it says right in there, HaGioris and the Kohen. America was a Hefkevelt. I have to give up. Rafal. They're talking about Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, and you're talking about Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Herman. That's a completely different personality. No, that's a perfect. Herman is a different personality. Sir.
Have you been successful in persuading any of the yeshivas to incorporate your curriculum?
No. I say that a friend of mine who is principal in a yeshiva, he keeps bothering me. He came over to me last week. Won't you teach math B for me? Math B. That's the integrated math B. That's the second year of the curriculum in Mathematics High School. I said to him, look, David, I'm willing to teach Ayin Mishulash for you in the 12th grade. That I'll do, and I'm willing to teach a supplement to Jewish American history. No, they won't let it. I thank you, folks. Oh.
I make one last comment about introducing curriculum. Besides being here in the shul, I'm also principal at the time, Berlin High School.